Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Deborah Lehman's new book, Spinoza, The Outcast Thinker, is a National Jewish Book Award winner in the category of young adult literature. Introducing her unusual subject for younger audiences, Lehman hones in on his contemporary relevance.
The man who eventually became known as Benedict de Spinoza was born nearly 400 years ago, but many of his ideas have a surprisingly modern ring. Spinoza was one of history's most passionate advocates of freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and freedom of religion, all of which have become pillars of today's democracies. His views on the major subjects he touched, the pursuit of happiness, the power of reason, the pitfalls of religious creeds, the authorship of the Bible, the ideal form of government, speak just as urgently to us today as they did to his 17th century audience. During Spinoza's lifetime, his ideas posed such a fundamental challenge to traditional ways of thinking that he became a reviled outcast, first from the Dutch Jewish community into which he was born, and then from Europe's wider intellectual, religious, and social scene. But Spinoza was undeterred by the storm he unleashed and spent his life entirely committed to his quiet pursuit of truth.
Here to talk to me about Spinoza, the outcast thinker, is Deborah Lehman. I'm so happy to have you here on Counterpoint.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Deborah, when I came across your book, I bought it for my 11-year-old daughter, but I wanted to make sure she would connect with it, so I started reading it, and I just found I couldn't put it down. I think it's a great introduction to Spinoza, no matter your age, but why did you want to write a book about Spinoza, of all people, for young adults?
In other words, what possessed me, I think is more the question. I am, by profession, more a teacher than an author, and several things kind of came together. I'll speak more generally about why I wanted to do this kind of book and then take up the specifically Spinoza question. I've been long frustrated, both as a teacher and also really as a parent, by what's out there for young adults. There's so much steamy sex and dysfunctional families and vampires, and all of that's fine and good. I have no objection to it. But when there's so little else out there for kids, really good stuff that they can sink their teeth into and really think about passionately, I think there's a real problem. And in nonfiction in general, I'm sure a lot of listeners will relate to this, there's a kind of hourglass shape to what goes on with the different age ranges. You've got tons and tons of wonderful nonfiction literature out there for kids. Everything from how crayons are made, how members of an orchestra get dressed up before they go to a performance. I mean, it's wild, varied, fun. You get to middle grades, there's still stuff, you know, the biographies of the presidents and Betsy Ross and inventors and that sort of thing. By the time you get to high school, there's practically nothing, really almost nothing. And then once again, once you get to adults, there's tons and tons of stuff out there. And as a teacher, I see that kids really have special needs in the young adult years for a special kind of nonfiction. Often the adult nonfiction assumes way too much background knowledge these kids don't have. Sometimes the vocabulary is too difficult. I had a child who read Ayn Rand and discovered that Ayn Rand was deeply influenced by Nietzsche and wanted to read something about Nietzsche. I couldn't find anything appropriate for this kid. So I think there is a demand out there. I think there's a real need for it. Why specifically Spinoza? Well, a lot of it, you know, is some of it is personal. My own history. I grew up, or I went to an Orthodox Jewish girls' high school. I first heard about Spinoza in a Jewish history class where his name was mentioned with a little bit of that hush that I remembered my older relatives using when they discussed cancer. It was clear that he was forbidden, he was bad. And of course, there's no way to get a kid more interested in something than telling that kid it's forbidden. And I didn't pursue it. I didn't pursue my interest in Spinoza for a very long time, but it was always back there in my head as, oh, I gotta find out more. And, you know, as I began reading about him, my more recent interest was spurred on by a friend recommending that I read Jonathan Israel's book, The Radical Enlightenment. The central thesis of that book is that Spinoza was really, really pivotal in bringing about the modern age. And I had to stop when I, you know, was only, I don't know, a quarter of the way through the book because I realized I just don't know enough about Spinoza. And as I read more about this man, I was impressed by the quiet dignity of his life. He was a modest, quiet man, and yet he had such an incredible impact on the world. And I found him deeply, deeply moving. And I guess one last aspect of all of this is, in Yiddish, there's a wonderful word, dafkanik. There's not a great translation in English, but it means someone who does things out of kind of oppositional defiance. And I'm that way as a teacher. You tell me that I can't do this, I can't get a kid to understand this concept, well, I'll show you that I can. And so Spinoza, you know, has this reputation of being this really difficult philosopher. And, you know, his book, The Ethics in particular, is considered one of the hardest books that exists in philosophy. I can show you that this is accessible to kids. Obviously not at the level of a great scholar, but accessible in a very intelligent, thought-provoking way to kids. That's why Spinoza.
So I understand you're now working on a book about Socrates. You mentioned Nietzsche. Is this about exposing young kids to philosophy, or is it about the great figures of the Western canon? Why do you think that's important?
The truth is, my interest is more, wow, this wonderful sweep of thought that we're all a part of. I just mentioned that I really, you know, I fell in love with Spinoza. I see the philosophers that I'm focusing on more as kind of the backbone to a story, but it's a bigger story. I think for kids in particular, having the storyline of a single figure through the book is helpful. But really, I want to give them a sense of, oh, all these ideas going back and forth and how they've developed. Also, the excitement of discovering that some very modern contemporary concerns were discussed back then. We had great minds back then working on some of the same issues. Yes, I'm working on biographies of philosophers, but I see it really is exposing the kids to broader things going on during those periods.
I have to say, as an intellectual historian, it's not just the sweep of ideas. You're really putting Spinoza into his context, and we're going to talk a lot more about that. Now, you open the book with the riveting scene of Spinoza being excommunicated from the Jewish community in Amsterdam in 1656. He was just 23 years old. Give us a close-up of what happened on that day, and then pan out to explain why Spinoza was banished from all contact with his family, friends, or associates in the Jewish community.
We know technically what happened on that day. He was excommunicated from the community. The word in Hebrew for it is cherem, and if I fall into using that word, it's just a very familiar word. Cherem means excommunication. It was actually a tool that was used quite commonly in the Amsterdam Jewish community, mainly as a slap on the wrist, kind of like the way we would use, let's say, a temporary expulsion from school. It was mainly to teach the offender to toe the line in various ways. It was a temporary sort of thing. It lasted for a week, or it had, you know, different levels of severity. Spinoza's was above and beyond anything. He was kicked out. He was damned. He was forbidden any kind of contact whatsoever with the people he had spent his life with up until that point. We know that there was a gathering in the synagogue. A document was read. Actually, that document, the Portuguese version of it, is still on file in the Amsterdam City Archives. It was read in Hebrew in the synagogue. And basically, the document gave a history of his case, and it followed that up with a series of blood-curdling curses. And then it ended off with the regulations of how the Jewish community was to relate, or actually not relate at all, to Spinoza from that point on. And there were probably some audiovisual effects, probably blasts of the shofar, the ram's horn. There may have been candles made of black wax that were extinguished as a symbolic death of Spinoza. They might even have been extinguished in pans of animal blood to create a bigger impression. But what exactly Spinoza had done up to that point is the mystery. The document refers only to abominable heresies and monstrous deeds and doesn't go into any details. It sounds incredibly juicy. If we read a little bit retroactively, I mean, we know what the heresies were later on in his life, and presumably he was thinking along the same lines as a younger man. He was only 23, as you mentioned. Within 6 years, he wrote a bunch of books that started outlining his incredibly cogent, unified philosophy. And so probably he was already thinking in that direction at the time. So the heresies are not so difficult to understand. The monstrous deeds Gosh, no one really knows. I mean, it could have been nothing more than eating a non-kosher sausage or doing something that was in violation of the Sabbath. Who knows? We have no record. He was such a quiet man later in his life. It's hard to imagine him doing anything really outlandish.
I do want to get into what some of the provocative ideas were, and maybe we'll do that as we talk more about some of his works, what it was that he was questioning about God, about the Bible, about the immortality of the soul, about some of the other groups within Amsterdam that he was beginning to consort with, whose ideas challenged some of the leading figures within the city. But let's dial back a little bit and get some sense of how Spinoza, but also how the Jewish community, had come to the point at which he was verbally spat upon and ritually shamed. Tell us about Spinoza's family, how they arrived in Amsterdam, how Baruch or Bento Spinoza, these were his childhood names, was brought up, what the Jewish community was like in Amsterdam in the 17th century, which was really a golden age for the Dutch Republic.
Yes, it really was. I have to say, being a first generation born in America with at least one side of my family having been Holocaust survivors, I think that there's a tremendous parallel between what the Jews from Iberia were experiencing when they got to Amsterdam and what Jews were experiencing when they came post-Holocaust from Europe to America. This was the Goldene Medina, in Yiddish, that's the Golden Land. And Amsterdam was very much that for these people. Basically, Spinoza's family, back in the history lost to us, originated in Spain. There were Jews in Spain for hundreds and hundreds of years. And during the Middle Ages, they had a very good relationship with the Muslim rulers. In fact, that period in Jewish history is known as the Golden Age of Spain. Jews were royal advisors, they were doctors, they were scientists. They had arrived and they were important. As the Christian rulers started taking over Spain, retaking over Spain, it became more and more difficult for the Jews. There were mobs that would go around rampaging, killing, forcing Jews to convert. And of course, once they converted, they were subject eventually to the Inquisition if they were considered to be doing things that weren't loyal to Christianity, even though they didn't want to have a part of it at all, but they were forced to. There were still, though, some Jews who managed to survive all of this. They didn't convert. They managed to escape forcible conversion, and they remained loyal to their faith. But in 1492, Ferdinand and Isabella instituted the expulsion of Jews. Anyone who was still Jewish had to leave the country or convert. And so you had these people who had been through such a tremendous amount up until then, and they were the diehards. They lost everything, practically. They could take very little with them, but they did it because they were such true believers. And many of them made their way to Portugal because, of course, it's close. The language issues weren't as difficult as it would have been to imagine elsewhere. And there weren't a lot of places accepting Jews at that time. So you had this community in Portugal, which is where Spinoza's ancestors made their way to. And they were living faithful Jewish lives there. That worked only for a little bit of time because then the Jews in Portugal were forcibly converted and there was no expulsion. Leaving was not an option because the Portuguese rulers realized, you know, the Jews can bring in lots of good commerce. They're good for our economy. And so the Jews were forced to stay, but to stay as Christians. Now, they weren't interested in Christian life, and so they kept up their Jewish practices secretly. And we know them as crypto-Jews, hidden Jews. They might light their Sabbath candles in the basement, try and do a Passover Seder, whatever it was that they could do. Of course, as the generations went by, their Jewish knowledge waned. They didn't have access to Jewish schools and Hebrew. They had access to the Old Testament. That was really one of their only connections to Judaism, but none of the rabbinic literature that had developed over the ages. And they wanted to get out. They wanted to be able to be free to observe their Judaism, celebrate their traditions. And so many of them made their way to Amsterdam, which was then the most tolerant city in Europe at the time. They had to sneak out. It was a dangerous trip. They started trickling out, and the Amsterdam community was established in the early 1600s. And that sense of expanse, that sense of freedom was incredible. They set up synagogues and a magnificent school system. They had welfare organizations and their shops and their cemetery. It was really something incredible. And again, in most of Europe, Jews simply couldn't live. In Venice, which was one of the other great places to be Jewish, they had to live in a ghetto. Amsterdam wasn't like that at all. It was practically magical for them. And so in that context, you can understand that when Spinoza started questioning Judaism and religion in general, that was such a slap in the face for these people who had given everything for their faith. So that probably explains some of the severity of the excommunication.
And tell us quickly a little bit about Spinoza's family and his upbringing, what they were doing in Amsterdam.
We know that Spinoza's father dealt with importing and exporting dried fruit and various other commodities. Spinoza's family, basically one after another, they died around him. I mean, at the age of 21, I believe, he was already running the family business with his younger brother. That was basically all that was left. Spinoza's mother died when he was 5, and his father remarried. His stepmother died when he was a young man also. And so Spinoza ended up taking over that import-export business. A lot of the Jewish community was involved in that. As crypto-Jews who had been kicked out of the Iberian Peninsula, they actually had this incredible international network of people they knew around the world, even in the New World. And so they were able to establish business ties fairly easily, and they were good at it. He doesn't talk a lot about his life, but one little bit that he has to say about his life was his disillusionment at that point in his life, that he saw that people were pursuing material wealth to make themselves happy, among other things, amorous connections. He was seeing what people were trying to do to make themselves happy, and he felt that that wasn't the route that he wanted to take. He was very distressed as a business person, but what that did give him was connection to the outside world. You know, he grew up in a fairly cloistered community in Amsterdam, certainly as a child. You know, wasn't an imposed ghetto, but just went to school there. He prayed there. I mean, his life was centered in the Jewish community. And when he entered the business world, he really made contacts with other people. He encountered collegians who were liberal-thinking Protestants who would meet on a weekly basis in colleges. They called them colleges, which is why they were called collegians. But it was just a group of people. It's not like what we think of as a college building. And they would study the Bible together. And so he got involved with a bunch of collegians. He was exposed to the philosophy of Descartes, which became very important to him. He started studying Latin. He hadn't known Latin. And of course, at that time, if you wanted to pursue any scholarly interests, Latin was essential.
So you've given us a fairly full picture now of the young Spinoza. He's growing up in this Jewish community, but he's beginning to question many of the ideas that were central to that community. He's also being exposed to the larger life of this significant Dutch Republic empire at the time, to all kinds of new ideas, new approaches to the Bible, new ideas within philosophy. I have to say, though, Deborah, one of the things that I love about the book is that you bring a lot of this to life through the illustrations, which really let readers visualize parts of the story that you're telling. We get maps to locate parts of the city, paintings by Rembrandt and other artists, engravings, they're all from the period. So you must have spent a lot of time locating these and then getting permission to use them. Why was it so important to include as scaffolding for your narrative for young adults these visual sources?
Mainly, it was great fun. It was so much fun to find these images, explore them, research them. I don't know what people did before the internet. This would not have been possible for me. But I think part of that grows out of my work as a teacher. You know, when you're in front of a group of kids, all of whom learn in different ways, you're trying to find any way you can reach them. And for some kids, it's pictures. For some kids, it's going to be diagrams. For some kids, it's music, whatever it is. And so I wanted to have a little bit of that in the book. And I guess the other aspect of it for me, also related to my work as a teacher, is we talk about something called the teachable moment. You know, you see a spark in a kid's eye about something you said, and you run with it, even if it's not on your lesson plan for the day. And I found as I was writing, I wanted to run with so many cool ideas, other things that came up, and I couldn't because I needed to preserve, you know, some manageable narrative. And what I did as I was writing was I had a file in my computer called Rejects. And I didn't throw anything away. I just saved all of those things that I had written actually originally as part of the text. And when I decided to get rid of them, I put them in the Rejects. And it was from there that I kind of developed directions for which pictures to use. Some of that ended up in my notes in the back section. It's just a lot of cool excursions.
A lot of those end up, I think, underneath the illustrations. You can almost read the book just through the illustrations, and they're almost like hyperlinks to all these ideas. It's interesting to learn that that's what you were doing. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm talking to Devra Lehman about her new book, Spinoza, The Outcast Thinker. One of the interesting things about Spinoza is that once excommunicated from the nation, that's the way they referred to themselves, the nation of Jews, he doesn't convert to Christianity, but he becomes a self-supporting lens grinder and an independent scholar, and he begins to publish. He's an author, and as such, he's really influenced by many of the new developments of the scientific revolution of the 17th century. Devra, tell us a little bit about science and philosophy in the 17th century. You mentioned Descartes, he's the key figure, and how these affected Spinoza.
If you take scientific thought during the Middle Ages, you're dealing with scholasticism, which is based on Aristotelianism. Essentially, the natural world is viewed as being imbued with spirit or soul, you know, to explain movement, to explain change. Basically, the approach is, well, a rock has some kind of soul in it, and that's why the rock falls towards the earth. A fire has some spirit that makes it rise upward. It's a very tradition-based view. You accept things simply because people have said them before, you know, the four elements we all learned about in school. Well, no one questioned that because it had been around for centuries. And so it was very tradition-based. It was also problematic for scientific development because if you say that an object has a soul, you can't really study that object very much. Why, when you drop a rock, does it move down to, you know, downwards? The soul in it wants it to move there. Okay, great. You know, you might trace that back to God, you know, the prime mover, but you can't go very far with that. In fact, Molière, his play The Imaginary Invalid, he has a student who wants to become a doctor taking an exam, the certification exam, and he's asked by his examiners, how is it that opium puts people to sleep? And his answer is, well, opium contains the virtue of putting people to sleep. And his examiners feel that that's just a wonderful answer. They applaud him. And of course, Molière is making fun of this whole approach where there's no possibility of science if an object is the way it is because of the soul that inhabits it. So Descartes comes along. And in this framework, he did a lot, but he introduced two things that were really, really very important. One is radical doubt. He didn't accept tradition. Start with questioning everything, including questioning your own existence, which is, you know, I think, therefore I am. How do we even know that we exist? Well, we know that we exist because we're thinking and something has to be doing the thinking, therefore we exist. That was one issue. Cast aside tradition, start afresh, think from the ground up. And the other thing that he introduced was the division between mind and body. He saw these as two separate substances. Mind we can kind of see more broadly as a spirit or soul, you know, that sort of non-physical aspect of existence, and body meaning anything physical. And he saw them as two separate substances in the world. It actually created problems for him because if they really are two separate substances, then how does one communicate with the other? How does my desire to, you know, take a cookie off a platter translate itself into my hand actually stretching out and doing that? But Descartes did not deny the existence of God or the existence of spirit, but he pushed them off to the side. And now, suddenly, the physical world could be studied on its own terms. And so that made scientific study and examination of the laws of nature, of gravity, all of that, it made it possible. Now, Spinoza was really, really intrigued by Descartes, especially in his early years. Descartes was extremely controversial at the time because, you know, he set God off to the side and he didn't accept the traditions. And so he was really very, very controversial at the time. Spinoza studied Descartes and, in fact, became a Descartes scholar. One of his first books was, in fact, a geometrical presentation of Descartes' ideas, which he had developed as a private tutor for a student who was studying Cartesianism. Now, Spinoza didn't actually agree with Descartes on quite a number of issues, and one of them was on this question of substance, whereas Descartes saw mind and body as being separate, and Descartes saw God as being above that entirely. Spinoza saw God, mind, and body as all part of one thing, just he called it substance, and this meant that there was absolutely no possibility of a transcendental God. God simply exists as the laws of nature. We're not talking about God is a spirit that inhabits the local boulder. We're talking about God is simply the laws of nature. That's what God is for Spinoza.
So in the 17th century, I guess Spinoza's picking up on these two sides, this notion in Descartes that I doubt, therefore I am, and also this new picture of the universe that's beginning to emerge, one based on observation and experimentation and expressed in mathematics, and sort of pulling those two things together in his own new philosophical justification. And as you just mentioned, God is nature. Now, in Spinoza's later years, there's a surge in religious unreason, as you title one chapter. There was a messiah named Sabbatai Zvi who was embraced by thousands and thousands of Jews across Europe and in the Middle East, embraced by thousands and thousands of Jews across Europe and the Middle East. And the Dutch Calvinists are gaining power in Spinoza's Holland. Into this mix, Spinoza drops a bomb. His explosive work, The Theological Political Treatise. We're not going to be able to talk about all the aspects of the way in which this book unleashed a firestorm of controversy. But tell us a little bit about the ways in which this sort of brings together Spinoza's heresies around a whole series of different issues, but also the way in which it makes Spinoza into one of the most important thinkers of modern democracy.
It all starts really with his view of God, Deus sive natura, God or nature, he says in the Ethics. God being nature, meaning there's no transcendental God. So you think about all of the different aspects of traditional religion, Judeo-Christian religion. Well, the Bible wasn't handed to Moses on Mount Sinai. It doesn't have any divine origin. It's a human work. It was compiled by many people over many years. It's really interesting to read Spinoza on the Bible because you see the origins of the documentary hypothesis that, you know, became more really developed in the 1800s and in the 1900s as well, the idea that different people composed the Bible over a period of time. So there's that. Miracles, no such thing. Miracles were understood as miracles only because people did not have an adequate understanding of the laws of nature. God is not above nature, so there's no way of breaking the laws of nature. Things just are. No chosen people. And certainly if he was already saying that when he was still a member of the Jewish community in Amsterdam, you can imagine why that might have been problematic for the people he lived with. No necessary rituals or commandments. Religion for Spinoza really was true religion was just, well, he talked about loving God, but loving God for him meant more like understanding the laws of nature, understanding the human place within this vast framework that we're a part of. It didn't have to do with going to a church or a synagogue and expressing any kind of love of a divine being and loving others. And that's really all that mattered. Now, what that meant was that the outward forms of religion, Spinoza felt, look, you know, whatever works for people, if it helps them be better people, fine. He didn't want it for himself. He didn't think any rational person needed it, but he didn't object to people doing what they wanted to do, as long as it helped them love God, as he put it, and love other people. So that led to a very, very passionate defense of freedom of religion. There's no reason for anyone to interfere with anyone else's beliefs or practices. Freedom of thought. What I think individually, it's my business and it's also my right. And anyway, how can you possibly stop people from thinking what they're going to think? It's not even practical to imagine stopping them. And freedom of expression, these things all grew out very organically from the starting point of God is nature. There is no transcendental God to tell us how to lead our lives.
So you mentioned that Spinoza's book, Ethics, is really difficult. I have to say that for listeners who want to take the next step, they really should just dive right into The Theological Political Treatise, because reading it even today, I think, it still has a kind of shock value, and you are discovering something early on about this entire critical tradition that leads to so many aspects of the modern world. Deborah, you sketched in your introduction the impact of Spinoza on the modern world, and you mentioned Jonathan Israel's important book, Radical Enlightenment. The subtitle says a lot, Philosophy and the Making of Modernity. But what I want to ask you in closing is, what is the kind of impact that you hope your book will have on the young minds who are its intended readers?
Well, since you mentioned Jonathan Israel, I'll just mention his blurb on my book was so, for me, heartwarming. He said, if I were a young person reading this, it would come as a revelation to me. And I thought, wow, if I can present a revelation or cause a revelation for another budding Jonathan Israel, wow, that's enough for me. Just one budding Jonathan Israel out there. So I'm hoping to inspire some kids in that direction. I hope some kids will read it and say, wow, I want to know more. I want to study Spinoza. I want to study intellectual history. I want to study philosophy, whatever it is. Obviously, it's not going to happen to a huge number of kids. I hope that others will at least develop some kind of passion for intellectual interests. Also, I think I worry a lot about the age that we live in. Kids are so much in the now, instant. You know, technology does that. We don't live with extended families. A lot of kids hardly have any contact with their grandparents. You know, we're kind of in this age where we don't look at the past very much. And I hope that a book like this helps kids to see there's a lot of value in the past. People were gnawing over the same issues that are still current. And then related to that goal, I think, is just a sense of humility. Humility in the face of this grandeur of the intellectual tradition that we are the heirs of. It's very important to me. And Spinoza is a particularly wonderful vehicle, you know, for this notion of humility, because he really was such a quiet man. Bertrand Russell, in his History of Philosophy, calls him the most lovable of philosophers. And as you read him, you really, really see why Russell would say that about him.
Well, you talk about the dramatic sweep of ideas. I just want to say one thing you didn't mention is Spinoza, the outcast thinker, is also just a great story. This is really engaging. And I am so pleased that you were able to share it with us today on Counterpoint. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.